Welcome to EB5 Investment Voice, where attorney insights intersects with immigration investments. If you are a foreign investor, domestic fund manager, or enterprising entrepreneur and want to get the most out of the EB5 program, you have come to the right place. I'm Mark Deal, and I'll be your co-host on this journey. I'm joined by your host, Mona Shaw, and other attorneys at Mona Shaw & Associates, as well as immigration leaders from around the world. So let's get into EB5 Investment Voice.
You know, Mark, there is just so much to deal with in the new law. So what we are trying to do is pull out different nuggets every week so that it simplifies it a little for our audience.
That makes sense, Mona. I know last week we explored concurrent filing, but what will we be talking about today?
Concurrent filing is such a big deal for so many people. So today is technically it's a bigger topic, but we're shrinking it a little. It's dealing with existing projects that a lot of developers have under the new law. So Mark, this episode, we want to deal with existing projects and how they are going to move forward under the new law. There's a lot to talk about, and we don't want to confuse our audience. So we thought we would handle it in a very succinct manner. And of course, who else could we ask to deal with in such a succinct manner but Rohit Kapuria?
Hey, Rohit. Welcome to the show.
Thanks, Mark. Thanks, Mona. Good to be back.
Rohit, you're my man when it comes to these kind of issues because you, I'm sure, like us, are being bombarded by questions and questions and questions.
Well, I appreciate the vote of confidence, Mona, and it's good to be back on here. And you are right. We are being bombarded with all sorts of questions. We're dealing with questions related to individuals who had structured a regional center program. And when the regional center program expired or lapsed in June of last year, 2021, they then pivoted into a direct EB-5 offering. And now, when the regional center is set to be reauthorized on May 14th, they are trying to pivot back into a regional center under the terms of the new law.
Yeah, exactly, Rohit. We do have a little bit of time because nothing can be filed until 60 days from the date of the enactment, which was what, March 15th? So we're looking at May 15th?
Correct. Well, May 15th is actually a Sunday, so it would have to be May 16th, which is a Monday.
I know, the magic May 16th. But here's the point, Rohit. We're already halfway through April, and there's no guidance from USCIS yet.
Which I unfortunately do not expect that we will be receiving that guidance even closer to or shortly after May 16th.
So hence, we're asking experienced people like yourself, Rohit, to be able to give a little bit of guidance to our listeners. Let's split this up. First of all, we have our folk who have their existing regional center projects, and those regional center projects were abruptly stopped back in June of last year. What about them? Can they restart their projects?
They can, Mona. However, the first thing that I would recommend is that they immediately double check whether or not the location of the project continues to qualify as a targeted employment area under the terms of the new law.
Well, that point affects everybody, even people who've had direct projects and now want to revert back to regional center projects.
That is correct. However, remember, under the terms of the new law, we are back into a very restrictive read of how TEAs are calculated. And so what I've noticed over the projects that we are currently working on that are existing and which want to come back, most of them, unfortunately, no longer qualify as target employment areas.
So here's the interesting thing, Rohit. We've been doing some investigation recently with some projects. And because of COVID, we still have some eschewed results. Places in New York, which I don't expect to be TEA areas, have come up as TEAs. Mm. I'm sure that's going to be a case across the board in the big cities, wherever they had a problem with COVID.
Well, for those individuals, they are in luck then, because they can definitely proceed.
What about folk who had a direct pool project? We're advising them to completely have a new offering. What are you advising?
I agree with you. There is a little bit of a dispute within the industry as to how they interpret the new law vis-a-vis pool directs. I think the governing wisdom as of now from most experts, including you, Mona, are that the law appears to remove the ability for a direct project to continue to provide pooled direct optionality to investors. Therefore, for those individuals that can no longer do this, they would have to either A, revert to utilizing a regional center, or B, to the extent they're able to unbuckle their existing structure and create separate job creating entities, they may be able to bring in single investors into each of those components. But that obviously is quite complicated and may not be worth the hassle.
Yeah, but I do know a number of regional center, a number of projects wanting to do that because they don't want to wait until May 15th and they do have existing investors who just didn't get their act together. So they are trying to do that. But that's a whole topic in itself, Rohit. Why do you think, I'd just like to know your opinion, why do you think that the law was designed this way?
It's an interesting question, Mona. In my view, I believe that USCIS was looking for a way by which it could control or rather better supervise the regional centers and the underlying principles of the deal. Because if you think about it, from a jurisdictional standpoint, the agency has jurisdiction over regional centers. It has jurisdiction over EB-5 investors, but it technically does not have jurisdiction over the job-creating entities. And so that's why they're looking to at least exert a little bit more control so they can better police the intent of the program.
I totally agree. But I would also say there was another issue, which unfortunately we're going to hear once these all of these direct pools get adjudicated, is that some of the direct pools corporate structure just didn't fit direct. It was more of a regional center structure. And that's always been a problem with direct pooled. So I feel like that was another factor in this issue. But I agree, first and foremost, this whole bill is about policing.
Well, that's interesting, Mona. Let me tell you something about some of this policing stuff that's going on. There's a lot of interpretational issues, but there are a lot of points that are very clear. The most important facet, it relates to the regional center. And if we look at the old regional center model, we had various different structures, but there was an abundance of these so-called rent-a-center models. And that's where a regional center would enter into a basic commercial transaction with a new commercial enterprise and its principals, would get paid some amount upfront, and on the back end would get an annual payment per investor just to conduct its compliance duties. So at the forefront, it was very much commercial in nature, but the oversight and the obligations of the rent-a-center regional centers was not much. Therefore, under the terms of the new law, they now have to be really involved in the intricacies of the underlying development. Not only do they need to comply with reporting requirements, but they really need to participate in most of the offerings from at least a representation and warranty standard.
Yeah, let me just jump in, Rohit. You know, I was just listening to one of the ILW webinars, and Laura Reef was discussing how they got to the place that we are here. And she did bring up a point, which I really thought was a good point, that the senators and Congress just definitely are frowning on regional centers where the JCE owns the regional center. Their preference is rent-a-centers.
Yeah, that is correct. And I agree with Laura and I agree with you on that point. It's been a traditional model. You've had individuals who come from a private equity background. They've hopped into this space and they've created regional centers for the specific purpose of sponsoring. Yeah. And you have developers who have wanted to have that control because at the end of the day, the argument, which is a good argument, is, well, if we are the underlying developer, then we have a self-interest to ensure that the regional center remains strong and remains in a position to continue its work. But there are, of course, the conflict of interest issues.
Of course.
And if those are not properly disclosed, well, you could have an issue downstream.
I think we're seeing that, quite frankly. I think the conflict of interest has risen. There was a time many years ago that I didn't have a problem with putting up regional centers for developers, but I've been against this now for some time just because we've seen the conflict. So, yeah, I do feel that regional centers which are coming from the developers are going to slowly phase out. or they're going to face really, really harsh third-party audits and issues relating to their fund administration, which is all there for another topic. So back to our existing regional centers, Rohit. If one of our regional centers wants to get back on board, the first thing that we are telling them is that they do have to wait because we have to get them recertified. We don't know yet what recertification means, whether existing regional centers have to go through that or just the fact that we've just done their 924s in January rather than December is enough. What are your views?
I agree with you. I think it's going to be some sort of hybrid of the form I-924A, which was just done in December, as you indicated.
Yeah.
It would be extremely burdensome if USCIS interpreted the regulations to mean that all 700 plus regional centers have to go back to the drawing board and refile a form I-924 designation request. Because number one, that will take forever for USCIS to actually adjudicate.
Certainly not being able to be done before May 14th, I can tell you that.
Definitely not. And on top of that, it's also going to cost a lot of money, I imagine.
Yeah. $20,000 per regional center. But at the same time, I do understand this whole process of if you want a regional center to go forward this year, they have to register and they have to pay the $20,000 or else we'll see less regional centers. And I think that is the aim of the statute here.
Definitely. There is going to be a big pot of money that USCIS will have access to in order to better police. And of course, do not forget, each regional center has to also file for project approval. So an exemplar, as we've always deemed it, prior to any I-526 being filed. Therefore, USCIS is going to have a substantial amount of capital behind it, more so than it's ever had, in order to conduct all its activities under the terms of the Act.
Oh, there is a fee involved with exemplar petitions. I'd forgotten that. What, $18,000 or something?
Yeah, $17,765.
Yeah. Oh, wow. I hope we see more adjudication, or maybe USCIS is going to have a new wardrobe. Who knows? But hey, I've got a question for you, Rohit. Somebody asked me recently about a project that they had invested into prior to the June 30th change and the whole law coming in on pairing. And it was under the 900 level. So they had paid 900,000 into a project. And now that the law is definitely at 800,000, they want to know if they can get their 100,000 back from the project.
Difficult question. From a conservative standpoint, I do not believe they can. Because if they properly invested at the time the law required 900,000, then they're essentially grandfathered at that amount. If they were to now take down 100,000 as a refund because we have a new law, well, we have to remember this law is prospective in nature and it applies to new filings. It does not apply to retrospective filings. So I do not believe that is going to be an option. That notwithstanding,
if that same project now does the same offering completely differently in the sense that the same offering is now at 800,000, and nothing has changed except the amount?
We would just create a separate class of investors. So you could have your class A investors who were at the 900,000, your class B investors who were at 800,000. And theoretically, if this is an older project and had investors at 500, you could have your class C at 500,000. They would all be treated in pro rata in terms of distributions, I imagine. However, the amounts would have to necessarily be different.
Yeah, I happen to agree. Oh, yeah, Roy, you did mention before that one of the first things that these existing projects have to do is check the TEA designations. There's a lot out there on the web, maps and things. What do you advise as the safest way to look at a map or something else?
Definitely contact an EB5 economist.
I agree.
This is something we do not want to take lightly. We understand that USCIS is going to have final jurisdiction and ability to determine whether or not it qualifies, but you do need an expert economist to make that determination for you.
Yeah, and also bear in mind that last Thursday there was new data which came in, and many of the maps online are not updated. So I think, yes, an economist is the way to go. even if you have to pay a little bit to the economist, because the last thing you want is to pay an awful lot of money to lawyers and everybody else doing documents and then find out that you don't even have the TEA designation. But saying that, I'm of the opinion that even if a project is not in a TEA, for many of our existing projects, I don't think it's that harmful. Because there's only, what, 200,000, 250,000 difference?
Yeah, there is. And, you know, it's interesting. This is the first time in my career I can recall when a large number of issuers are actually contemplating a $1,050,000 offering. It's the same analysis. $250,000 differential, not that much. Sweeten the pie a little bit for these investors so that their return on investment is better than what you would give an $800,000 investor. And obviously provide more bells and whistles as to make the project more attractive.
I feel that the reason they're able to do that is because we are looking at a different type of investor. That if an investor can come in at 800, which eventually will be 900, they equally could come in at $1,005,000.
That is correct. That is correct.
You know, Roy, we've been throwing around terminologies like exemplar petitions, and I do forget. I know, Mark, you're going to tell me off. many of our listeners won't even know what an exemplar petition is. So first of all, would you like to explain what is an exemplar petition?
Sure. Simply put, an exemplar petition is a filing that a regional center does seeking pre-approval of an underlying project and its underlying documentation. That includes the offering documents, the business plan, and the economic impact report.
Right. Now, this has been around for a while. It's not something new. But the reason that many projects did not go forward with an exemplar petition was the time that USCIS was taking. If we filed a project with an exemplar petition and a 526, our 526s would be approved way before the exemplar petition would get approved.
That's correct. The intent of the exemplar was to provide a level of consistency when it came to adjudication. Because when an investor files an I-526 petition, USCIS is adjudicating their source of funds and is adjudicating the project. So the idea was, well, if USCIS adjudicated the project previously and approved it, it would be less work for them to do when they adjudicated the investor's source of funds.
Yeah, well, that was the idea. But then we did come across many instances where USCIS, even though they had approved an exemplar petition, they would still send an RFE at a later stage. A lot of times, because of the time it would take to fill up a project, there would be some material changes or some changes. So we're hoping we don't have that. Or even if something like that happens, we're hoping that we do have the opportunity to at least be able to contact USCIS directly and save time. I mean, all this is, we're waiting to hear from USCIS, and hopefully they'll move into 2022 and not be stuck in the 1990s.
I agree. You know, within the law, there is now a provision in there that allows USCIS to automatically include in a pending 526 the approved amendment that's part of the 924, which is the exemplar. So previously, if a regional center had filed an exemplar request in January of 2022, the investor filed an I-526 in March of 2022, and USCIS subsequently adjudicated the exemplar request, they would have the ability to take that exemplar approval and then drop it into each of the 526s so that there would be consistency. That was never there before. So that's a welcome addition.
Definitely. Well, what about a project who had spent the money, a few years back or 2 or 3 years back? Are you seeing, or is your reading of the law that we can utilize the same exemplar petition and just maybe add to that?
Unfortunately, that is not my reading. And this has been a sore topic with a number of my clients who are looking to restart these existing projects.
Yeah, I can imagine that's a lot of extra money.
Yeah. It is a lot of extra money, but and there's actually a gray area in there. So you have two categories. You have the projects which had the approval already and which are looking to restart. And you have those who had filed for an exemplar, but have not yet gotten adjudicated and are now looking to go back into market.
So what happens to those individuals?
In my read of the bill and history with USCIS, I unfortunately have a feeling that any pending exemplar and any previously approved exemplar are essentially out the window. We can probably seek to request some sort of deference in a new filing, but it is not clear that USCIS is going to give that to us because we have a brand new EB-5 law.
Yeah. My gut feeling is the same. I think they're like, all right, that was all water under the bridge. Too bad. This is what it is today. So that would mean if we had a new filing, of course, there's new TEA designations, and of course, there's new figures. There has to be a change anyway. So I can see USCIS doing that for sure. Overall, though, Rohit, you see a lot of increased costs for existing regional centers and existing projects?
Absolutely, Mona. Outside of the fact that they have to file these exemplars, which are roughly $18,000, they have to also file the annual form I-924A, which they previously had to do, $3,035 right there. They had to pay legal fees associated with filing, so however much their law firm would charge. Now, on top of that, they now have to file, now they actually have to contribute $20,000 each year to the Integrity Fund. So owning a regional center has become extremely expensive.
Yeah, I definitely see that. Do you see that it's going to deter, you know, real projects moving forward? Because I actually don't. I feel like some projects will really welcome the fact there's going to be less on the market.
Yeah, there is going to be a market shrinkage, no doubt. And the hope is that the very well-capitalized regional centers, which have good staying power, will continue to stay.
Yeah.
Those that did not and were essentially operating on shoestrings would have to exit.
The strong will survive.
Yeah, it's true, Mark. We had far too many. I mean, that at one point, there were so many projects out there. There was nowhere near the amount of investors that we had of projects and regional centers. And then there was this whole cottage industry of just creating regional centers unnecessarily. So I feel that this is a good move, and I'm hoping it shakes itself out and the costs really start to not be unbearable and they are still profitable. Because if it's not profitable, we're not going to get investors. We're not going to get good projects.
Right. Didn't we have like 1,200 projects or something like that when we first started the show, like 6+ years ago?
Ah, the golden age of EB-5. Remember those days, Rohit?
Oh, yes. I think we are back to another golden era, actually. There is much to celebrate with the new law. There is much that is not clear, but there are a lot of things that are promising. And so I'm especially looking forward to this.
No, me too, actually. I'm quite excited. And I certainly don't see any hesitation in moving forward. It's still the cheapest program in comparison to programs in, for example, like the UK or Quebec or Australia by like 2 million, a million and a half or something. So I don't see it really hurting the program too much. The increased amount, I should say. And the integrity measures, I'm sure you'll agree with me, is only going to enhance the program for outside investors.
It will, and it also brings a lot more predictability. We were previously operating on these multiple extensions because we were part of the continuing resolution. So it is now a welcome issue that we have a 5-year designation term, and we also have grandfathering of pending petitions. So that is something that was not in existence in the past.
Mm. One last question relating to our existing projects. There's a lot of talk about the cap. Now, we have a small percentage put aside for infrastructure projects and for rural projects. I don't expect there are many existing infrastructure projects around the country. That is probably new. But I can imagine there's a ton of rural projects out there. That's going to be very interesting to see how those fill up now, because the cap is allowing a set aside in visas for those projects itself.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting you bring that up, Mona. Majority of my issuer clients either have an existing rural project or are currently seeking one. And the asset classes vary across the board, but the governing wisdom is if you have a project that is rural, and if it is a good asset class and that which has a lot of capital behind it, it is going to sell very well and potentially is also going to open up the currently retrogressed China market.
You know, Rohit, so many of these projects have been sitting, and regional centers have been sitting doing nothing for the last 9 months. They can't wait to get out and market. We are being contacted by a ton of agents who want to understand what they want to do because they have investors that they've been holding on to and they've been stopping them from going into direct projects for months and months.
You are correct, Mona. A lot of agents have actually also been reaching out to us. The governing question right now is under the law, they have to register with USCIS. And there is also a provision that USCIS or Department of Homeland Security is going to maintain a database, whether public or private, that will include the identities of these agents. We don't know how that's exactly going to work. That being said, the reason why this is coming up now is because under the integrity provisions, it is clear that Congress wants the investors to be aware of and to have notice of all fees that are being paid. So this disclosure requirement is new. I expect that some agents who were previously operating are going to come out of the industry, just like regional centers. Yeah. And I expect that many will remain because they will welcome the provision of registration as well. We just don't know how that is all going to shake out.
Yeah, but I do know, and as you know, that many agents don't want their investors to know how much they make. And now that is all going to be apparent.
It is. It is. But from a developer standpoint, the advantage for them is their compliance requirements are better because most borrowers previously operated in a vacuum. They were not aware how the issuers raised the capital. So now it's going to be clear for them. Most investors were not aware of what fees were being paid. It is now going to be clear to them. And most rent-a-center regional centers were not aware how the issuers with which they had a sponsorship agreement were paying agents. So all round, this is going to be a lot more integrity and a lot more transparency. And I think most of us in the industry welcome this.
So it sounds like dealing with existing projects under the new law is going to be easier. Rohit Kapuria, thank you so much for coming on Global Investment Voice.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me, guys.
Thank you for being with us today on EB5 Investment Voice. The topics presented in this podcast is informational in nature and is not to be taken as specific legal advice. If you have questions on the topics presented in this episode or other investment immigration needs, please contact Mona Shaw and Associates. Mona and her attorney staff can be reached at mshawlaw.com. That's mshahlaw.com. Make sure you don't miss our next episode focusing on a different aspect of the EB5 program by subscribing to the podcast. While you're at it, leave us a rating on iTunes. If you really found this episode valuable, share it with someone else that could benefit from this information. Until then, I'll see you on the next episode of EB5 Investment Voice.